All right, we come to Aristotle now as the second major systematic philosophy of the ancient world. I believe this will be Roman numeral 10, your outline. And what I'd like to do to present Aristotle to you, I know that you've done some reading on your own, so you have some general idea of what his philosophy is like. I'd like to go over my own annotations on W.T. Jones' discussion of Aristotle, which I find very helpful. And then after I've done that, go back and give, I have what is basically a one-page summary of his philosophy, so we can kind of encapsulate everything. But let me meander for a while here using Jones as our structuring device. First, some details about his life. He was born in the year 384 B.C. At that point, Plato was 43 years old, so he's already in mid-age when Aristotle was born. Aristotle doesn't immediately become a student of Plato, so I want you to see that he would have been, Plato would have been deep into his career as an academician, the leader of the academy, by the time Aristotle was on the scene. Aristotle never knew Socrates. Socrates had died 15 years prior to Aristotle's birth. And Aristotle was not born in Athens. He was not a native of Athens. He was born in Stagira, S-T-A-G-I-R-A, in Thrace. And his father was a physician, interestingly, and a physician to the king of Macedonia. When Aristotle was 17 years old, his father tried to complete his education at a distinguished institution, so he sent him to college, Athens, to study at Plato's Academy. Aristotle was greatly impressed by the insights and creativity of Plato, and yet apparently Plato's approach to the nature of reality, his dualism, never settled in for Aristotle. He, early in his career, tried to think that way, but he found it increasingly inadequate as an explanation of the nature of reality, and especially of nature itself, the world in which we live. And so he does not completely reject Plato. It's not as though he falls back on Democritus, the materialist, after all, but he does want to reformulate what he thinks are the good insights of Plato and make it a more relevant philosophy for the natural world in which we live. For Aristotle, as for Plato, there is a public, objective, and knowable reality. And yet we can also answer the question, what is the good life for man? We are not left with the relativism of the sophist, according to Aristotle. We can give an account of the natural world that affirms the public, objective, knowable reality that is there without giving up a moral perspective for man, the good life for man. Aristotle, in a way similar to Plato, wanted to reformulate the traditional beliefs of the Greeks. He didn't want to be a revolutionary. He wasn't trying to introduce new values, you know, like some kind of hotshot that's come up with a faddish way of living that throws off the wisdom of the elders. He wanted to reformulate the traditional beliefs of the Greeks by putting them within a comprehensive metaphysical system where they would not seem arbitrary, where they could be harmonized with the nature of reality or the world of nature and change round about man. So Plato had provided his metaphysical scheme in which he could answer the atomist and the sophist and the traditionalist simultaneously. And likewise, Aristotle offers a comprehensive metaphysical scheme where he can explain the nature of the world round about us, say reason as a means to finding objective reality, and maintain that there is an ethical perspective and dimension to man. Aristotle stayed at Plato's Academy until Plato's death, which was in 347 B.C. And apparently he, coming from an aristocratic family, was able to spend some years traveling about, getting to know the world, having lots of experience, and I mean that in the noble sense, not in the partying sense. That is, he was able to learn a lot about the world and see different cultures at work and so forth. And then in the year 343 or perhaps 342 B.C., he became a paid tutor to a young man named Alexander. Alexander was the son of King Philip of Macedonia. You know him from history as Alexander the Great. It's pretty fascinating when you think about it. Here you have the man Socrates, who is a great and wise philosopher who caused enough trouble that they executed him. Socrates' best student is perhaps the most important philosopher in Western history, Plato. Plato has plenty of students. His best student turns out to be the great rival in the history of philosophy to his own outlook, and that is Aristotle. Aristotle's best-known student is Alexander the Great. So this all ties together the chain. However, it should be pretty obvious that Alexander did not adopt the outlook of Aristotle. Aristotle taught him for 2 years, maybe 3 years. But if we look at Aristotle's views about political values and his views of the Greeks over against other men and so forth, it is very clear that Alexander did not agree with Aristotle. He had a political regime quite opposite of what his mentor had taught, and he had attitudes toward the superiority of the Greeks that did not fit into Aristotle's cosmopolitan perspective at all. Well, so he taught this great potential ruler, Alexander, and that lasted for only 2 or 3 years. In the year 335 B.C., he went back to Athens, this time to set up a school of his own. And the name of his school was the Lyceum. So Plato had his academy, which was still in operation, by the way. Aristotle had his Lyceum. And while he was running that school, he wrote treatises on a large number of subjects. He wrote treatises on physics and biology and logic and ethics and on and on. And it is suggested by W.T. Jones that these treatises that we have by Aristotle are probably notes that he wrote for his students to give lectures. And then later they collected these notes together and put them in topics under, you know, topical headings, and then would publish them as Aristotle on Physics, Aristotle on Ethics, or what have you. And the reason Jones suggests that, and other scholars with him, is that what we find in these treatises is sometimes fairly sketchy, at other times very systematically worked out. Sometimes they end abruptly, and it has all the marks of a collected work. Now, that means you have to be very careful when you are interpreting, say, a work that's labeled Politics. Because under the rubric Politics, whoever did this editing work will have put all of Aristotle's notes to himself, to his students, whatever, together. And that could include, over the wide number of years of his career, changes in his outlook. He could have seen things as a young man one way and altered it later. you know, if you take a look at my lecture notes and so forth, you can't always be sure how this ties in. Is this meant as a critical remark? Is it a descriptive remark? Things like that. So we have some interpretation difficulties with him as well. In the year 323, Alexander the Great died. And following upon that, there was a great public hue and cry against the Macedonian party. And that meant that Aristotle was somewhat threatened. And he decided in his old age that it would be the better part of valor to withdraw from Athens to the protection of a Macedonian garrison where he would not be threatened. And it may be that it's an apocryphal story, but it's often told that Aristotle, upon departing from Athens, said he did not want the Athenians to sin twice against philosophy. What was the first sin against philosophy committed by the Athenians?
Killing Socrates.
Exactly. They murdered Socrates. And so, if he didn't say it, it still is a fairly clever thing to have been said. Anyway, he left, but it only gained him about a year of life because he died of other causes about a year later. Okay, so enough about the life of Aristotle. Aristocratic young man, intelligent enough to take on his own teacher, one of the greatest philosophers in Western history, tutor to the emperor, Alexander eventually, and a man who founded his own school of thought, his own school for training people in philosophy in Athens. What did Aristotle want to do? The Milesians wanted to find out what the material universe was made of. What's the stuff of reality? The atomists wanted to find out what's this material made of. And so they offered their answer. But as we have seen already in this class, the materialistic answers offered by the Milesians and the atomists not only had particular problems explaining the natural world of change, they all the more were unable to give an adequate account of man as a moral creature. They could not account for that which we might call the religious side of man. They just had to reject religion as myth and as not intellectually respectable. Aristotle was not willing to dismiss man's human as opposed to natural side. He wanted the values and the ethics that were important to traditional Greek society to be reaffirmed. On the other hand, Plato tried to give an account of reality that was immaterial. We have the Milesians and the atomists being materialist on the one side, and Plato on the other side being an immaterialist. Plato gave a systematic account of reality, but it was in terms of another realm, a realm of forms or ideals that is apart from the physical world. And Plato was never able to give a satisfactory account of the relationship between the values that are found in the realm of ideals and the world of sense perception that is our daily experience. It could be said then that Aristotle took it upon himself to establish a theory of reality that accounted for the sense objects of daily experience as well as the transcendent values of ethics. That is, he wanted to account for the natural world around us without giving up the ethical dimension of man. And so if he had to disagree with Plato about the transcendence or separation of the forms and ideas, And on the other hand, he had to disagree with the Milesians and the atomists about the exclusion of ethical values when we study nature. This is a big task. He's going to try to give us an account of the natural world. He's going to try to solve the problem of change, and in giving an account of nature, also establish ethics in man as a, well, what we would today call a religious being. The major problem that Aristotle felt needed to be resolved by philosophers was the problem of change. Change seems to be irrational. If we say A changes into B, then if it's A that changes into B, B is A as well as B. But if A changes into B so totally that it's not A at all, then it's no longer A. So why do we say it was A in the first place? How do you have A changing into B without it turning out to be a contradictory account of what has taken place? The atomists reduced all qualitative changes to motion, atoms falling through space. Plato, in essence, just denied change. It's not that important. It's the shadowy world of sense perception, and that's not the intelligible world of forms or formulas anyway. Now, Aristotle figured if human reason cannot explain change, which is the most pervasive part of our daily experience, if human reason can't explain change, then maybe human reason is not an adequate tool for understanding at all. So the rationality of our worldview, or of his worldview, was going to be staked on the ability to explain change in the natural world. So again, he wants to account for the world of nature, especially the problem of change, and he wants to do so in a way that does not exclude human values, moral values. And so how did he do this? Plato had taught that what is intelligible is form, or formula, that which is common to all the particulars in a certain class. That's what makes them intelligible. The idea of duckness, or ideal of triangularity, or even better, the ideal of goodness. That's what is intelligible to man. Aristotle agrees with that. Aristotle was won over to the idea that what makes the world intelligible is the universality of characteristics, not the particularity of them. And so Aristotle does speak of the form of things, even as Plato would speak of the form of things. But this is a good point to make a little homily for you as budding philosophers. It should be obvious enough that though Plato and Aristotle both used the word form, they did not use it in the same way. Because for Plato, form is something that exists apart from the world of time and space. But Aristotle does not use the word form that way. He uses it for that which is intelligible within the realm of time and space. There are no ideals outside of this world for Aristotle. All ideals, all forms and ideas must be embodied in particulars that we find in the realm of time and space. And my little homily has to do with recognizing what you learned in logic about theoretical definitions. You remember in our course on logic that discussion of different kinds of definitions? We have stipulative, and we have lexical, and we have precising. Well, another kind of definition is a theoretical definition. Given a particular theory on a subject, a word will be used in a way that accords or reflects that theory. And so you may have modern scientist Einstein speaking of atoms and Democritus speaking of atoms, but they didn't mean the same thing by the word atom, because the word functioned within a theoretical framework. And likewise, Plato and Aristotle both had comprehensive metaphysical systems, and so they might use certain words, identical words like form, but because of the philosophy in terms of which they use the term is being defined differently. It's been given a different theoretical account. Okay, as I've said, in Plato's philosophy, you find the forms or ideas as separate from the world, apart from the world of time and space. They are universals of which the particular cows and ducks and triangles that we encounter in this world in some strange way mystically participate. Okay, and so you have Huey, Dewey, and Louie out on the pond, and they participate in the form of duckness. So the form is not something you can count in your natural experience. You don't count the ducks on the pond and go 1, 2, 3, and then you add a fourth thing that is duckness. For Plato, duckness is in a different realm altogether. For Aristotle, on the other hand, the form of things is always embedded in particulars. Aristotle was temperamentally as well as intellectually disposed against a dualistic metaphysic like Plato's. Aristotle thought that Plato's forms were kind of ghostly entities that were otherworldly and lacked relevance for explaining the world of day-to-day existence. And so Aristotle would say we can distinguish form from matter, but we cannot separate form from matter. We understand this difference between distinction and separation. If I have a cup, as I do right now in my hand, that has a particular shape, texture, size, weight, color, what have you, the fact that I cannot separate the color from the texture or the weight from the shape of a cup does not mean that the color and the shape and the weight are all the same. They can't be separated. I can't pull the color over here and have the shape here. Okay? But they are distinguishable. We still will speak of the color rather than the shape, or the weight rather than the size or whatever it may be. Likewise, Aristotle said, you can distinguish the form, but you cannot separate it from matter. Now, you may want to put a little asterisk in your notes, because he insists that that's the case, but later in his account of the way reason works upon the world, he really says the opposite. He says you can separate form from matter. That's what the mind does by means of abstraction. But in terms of his metaphysic, universals or forms are embedded in particulars. And so duckness doesn't exist in another realm. Duckness exists in Huey, it exists in Louie, and in Dewey. So according to Aristotle, reality consists of individual things, particular things. It exists in rocks and trees and animals and human beings. And each particular rock or tree or human being is a substance, according to Aristotle. Each is a substance.
that's crucial that you have in your notes, that reality is made up of particular things, particular substances. Reality is not the universal abstraction, which is Plato's view. Reality is the particular, Stewie, Dewey, and Louie out on the pond. They are particular substances. Now, every substance can be analyzed into two aspects, according to Aristotle. Every particular substance is made up of its whatness and its thisness. Okay, if I look at some particular object, I ask, what is that? Let's say it's Felix the cat that we're looking at. And of course, by giving that name, I've already given the answer what it is. But we're looking at this object that we call Felix the cat. That particular substance is a combination of two things. First, what it is, and that it is, or its thisness, if you will. What is Felix? What is Felix? Now, in answering that question, to understand this object, we have to see that it has things in common. It has properties in common with other objects like it. And that's what gives the whatness to it. That's what gives its form and intelligibility. And the answer, as you know, is it's a cat. What is it? A cat. But it's not enough to say what Felix is if we want to capture the full reality of Felix. If someone were doing an analysis of what you are, they would be telling the truth if they said you are a human being. But is that a full analysis of you? It's not just that you're a human being, you're this human being, this particular human being. And so by speaking of the classes into which an object will fall, by saying that you fall into the class of human being, you fall into the class of house builder, you fall into the class of book reader, you fall into the class of baseball player, whatever it may be. After you've said all of the what that a human being is, you still have not gotten to the individuality of the object that you're talking about. We like to think of ourselves as having a combination of what's about us that makes us totally unique, but even if we were in fact totally unique, in theory, if you enumerate all the things that I am, okay, a lover of Beatles music, okay, a person who writes philosophical analysis, a person who prefers barbecued swordfish to just about anything else we could eat on the planet, okay, on and on and on. It is still possible that after that full description of all the classes that I fall into, all the properties that I have that are common to other objects, you still would not have caught the individuality, because there might be another person who similarly loves Beatle music, barbecued swordfish, and all along. So if we're going to get to the individuality of something, we have to mention not just what it is, but that it is, or the thisness, the particularity of it. But where do we get the particularity? Let's imagine there was somebody who loved Beatles music, wrote philosophical analysis, and loved barbecued swordfish. Another strange creature like that in the world. If there really were, what would differentiate us, since we hold everything else in common? We have humanity in common, maybe identical looks, identical desires, on and on and on. Even if this person were a physical twin of Dr. Bonson, we would still be distinguished because my body is made up of different matter than that person's body, right? That person exists at a certain time and space, and I occupy a certain time and space, which is different from that. And so Aristotle said that what makes things like other things is their form. This is the whatness. And what gives them differentiation or individuality is their matter. So to put it very simply, for Aristotle, every particular thing, every particular substance that exists is formed matter. Formed matter. And we have to ask why any particular thing has the form that it does. Why does a hand have this form that I hold up and demonstrate to you? Why does the hand have this form? Why does a knife have a form different from a spoon? Somebody give me the answer to that. Let's take the knife and spoon illustration. Why does the knife have the form that it does and a spoon have the form that it does? Why can't we just reverse it and say, okay, we're going to use spoons for knives and knives for spoons? Yeah, there's nothing really deep and sophisticated about this. Do spoons make very good knives? Do knives make very good spoons? How come?
They're made for different purposes.
Yes, exactly. The knife is for cutting. The spoon is for scooping. And so when you try to scoop with a knife or cut with a spoon, you're going contrary to the very nature or form of something. Now use that illustration of the hand as well. Why does the hand have this form? Because the hand serves a certain purpose or function, to pick things up or to write with, on and on. The form that a thing has serves its function or its purpose. Indeed, the purpose, the aim or use to which we put something is what gives a unity to the whole object itself. We talk about the knife having the purpose of cutting, and that determines its form, its shape. But we can talk about more complicated things and see that what brings unity to a complicated object, like the unity of a hand. What unifies the hand? Well, it's the purpose to which the hand is put. That is the aim or use to which the hand is put, that makes the hand what it is. And so, on the board here, where I've written down whatness and form, we can now add the general idea of purpose or aim. The Greek word was telos, T-E-L-O-S. The telos is the end result, the aim, or the purpose of something. Now, if form serves the purpose, then matter becomes whatever opens the door to the opportunity of that purpose being served. Matter stands for the opportunity to develop in that direction. Now, W.T. Jones uses, I think, a helpful metaphor or illustration, I should call it, when he talks about a brick. Now, let's say clay is what is the matter of the brick. That clay presents the opportunity, it opens the door to the possibility of a brick being made. And when we make the brick, how do we make it? Well, we make it with flat sides, usually rectangular. And we do it because that will serve the purpose of the brick. What's the purpose of a brick? For building a wall. Okay, so instead of having just, you know, just globs of clay that you bake into just any, you know, size and configuration, out of which you could not make a wall, not very easily, you make the bricks uniform, flat, rectangular, and so forth. But if there were no clay, there'd be no opportunity for the thing to be a brick, to serve that purpose. And the brick's particular form is with a view to it going into a wall. And so everything, every particular substance that we find in this world, if you're going to understand it, you have to understand its opportunity level, its potentiality, what it could do, and what it's on the road to doing. You have to understand not only its potentiality, but also its actuality. But its actuality is always in the process, it's always looking forward to the use that's going to be given to it, its purpose. And thus for Aristotle, all the world forms a hierarchy of purposes. Clay has the potential for brickness. Bricks are made in the form they are with a view to their going into a wall. Walls are built for a purpose as well. Okay, so you see how we move from clay to brick to wall to what? Should we just say security? Family security is one purpose for a wall. All these things are related to each other in a hierarchy of purposes. Every particular thing that we analyze then, this is not exactly accurate, but I think it will get the point across. Everything has its history and its future. Everything, to be analyzed properly, you have to look back at its matter, that is its potentiality, and you must look forward to the purpose that it's going to serve. And so this is why Aristotle called the form of any particular thing its actuality. And the matter from which it is made, its potentiality. So by differentiating between potentiality and actuality in every particular thing we find in the world, Aristotle felt he could give an account of how things endure through change. How they endure through change. What is it, when we say A has changed into B, how can A still be A and yet not A, that is B? And if it's not A any longer, why do we say it was A in the first place that changed? Aristotle felt he had given an account of this because there's something that endures, the matter, and there's something that changes, the form. Okay, so we look at your baby picture and we look at your high school graduation picture and we say, boy, the form sure has changed. But the matter hasn't. It's the same body that has developed into a new form. So you have the possibility of identity through time. Identity enduring the process of change. The form changes, but the matter stays the same. So if we look at an acorn, we have to realize that its form or its purpose, that which the acorn is going to serve, is an oak tree. Acorns grow into an oak tree. And so the acorn has the potentiality in it already to be an oak tree. But it doesn't have the form of oak tree just yet. So the matter is the same, its potentiality. What changes is the outward form. We're looking at it now in the form of an acorn. Given time and development, it will take the form of an oak tree. And that's why you have potentiality that stays the same and actuality that does the changing. The forms are altered through time. And every individual, according to Aristotle, is in a process of development where what a thing is not yet becomes its potential. It becomes itself by realizing the form that was at first only its potential. In fact, the form of oak tree-ness is acting upon the matter of the acorn, shaping and molding it to come along into the form of an oak tree.
The definition of matter is not the same as a modern-day scientific definition of matter.
Very good. I hope that you will notice here that though our illustrations are easier when we talk about clay bricks and a physical thing like an acorn growing into an oak tree, matter is not to be identified with matter in the sense that the atomist did, or like, you know, the physical stuff of reality. Matter is literally the potential for form. The matter of the acorn is what is, well, it's its potential for becoming an oak tree. And this understanding of form, which is not at all like Plato, form is a kind of driving force that works its way to fulfillment. You have the form arising out of the matter. Now, a moment ago, Jay made a good remark about